21-60-76, Lisa Price, personal representative of the estate of Nikki Miller versus Montgomery County et al., Keith Craycraft, John Fife, in his individual capacity. Oral argument as follows, 15 minutes for the plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Ms. Lovey for the plaintiff appellant.
I'll be reserving 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Great, thank you.
Good morning, I'm Deborah Lovey from Lovey & Lovey on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Lisa Price, who's representative of the estate of Nikki Miller. This court has been presented with two very different versions of the facts, and that should signal to the court that this is not a case that can be disposed of on summary judgment. I'd like to begin this morning with the fabrication of evidence.
Do you want to address the motion to dismiss?
Sure, I'm happy to begin with jurisdiction. Your Honor, this court's ruling in Jackson makes it very, very clear that Section 1983 claims should all be considered classified in the same way for survivorship purposes. Which means that the naming conventions does not dictate whether or not the survivorship law applies. If you look at Jackson, the ruling could not be any clearer. It says all Section 1983 claims must be treated the same way for survival of claim purposes. The court's language could not be clearer. The appropriate level at which to generalize a Section 1983 claim under state law is as a personal injury action sounding in tort and nothing further. So the claims get defined at the federal level. This court is very clear that federal law defines it.
So your friends on the other side suggest that Jackson is distinguishable because it's Ohio and not Kentucky. Is that?
That is absolutely irrelevant. The important thing is that claims get defined at the federal level, not at the state level. And what Jackson says, regardless of which state you're looking at, Section 1983 claims should all be classified in the same way. So it doesn't matter whether you're calling it fabrication of evidence or whether you're using the naming convention, malicious prosecution, or whether you're calling it what it actually is, which is a violation of process without probable cause. The naming conventions don't matter, nor frankly does the statute matter. What Jackson says is that they all get classified the same way for survivorship purposes, and when you look at them all at the same way, it's clear that personal injury actions under Kentucky law.
Well, but assuming that it survives, what's your best claim here that you want to talk about?
I would
talk
love
about the benefits of, or the best quality of your claim here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you. I would love to begin with malicious prosecution. I'd love to begin with fabrication of evidence. Now, the defendant's entire argument on that claim involves disputes of fact, not law. If you recall, there's no evidence at all implicating Mr. Miller except for Natasha Martin's statement. And we have certainly presented sufficient evidence of defendant's knowing fabrication of that statement, where everything in her statement was fed to her by the defendant officers.
Well, the grand jury issued an indictment in this case, did it not?
It did, Your Honor, but it did based on fabricated evidence. And so if you...
What was the most fabricated of all the evidence? Is it what this lady said, Ms. Martin, or is it somebody else's?
Well, there are sort of two sets of fabrication. One is what is found in Defendant Charles's report, which is why the indictment doesn't matter. But the second most, the most significant thing is Ms. Martin's entire statement was fabricated by the defendants. The defendants knew that it was false. Our evidence shows that the defendants knew that it was false, and yet they presented it.
It just seems like a very odd way to make a fabrication claim. I understand that you think the statement is false and that maybe she was saying things that the police and others wanted her to say. How is that guess I'm struggling with that part.
Right, and I understand it. And that's why I cite to Hurt, because I think Hurt in the Seventh Circuit is very useful in its discussion of this. But also in this circuit, you have Spurlock, which talks about the solicitation, that when you solicit false testimony, when you give it to a witness and you have them actually parrot it back, then that is a fabrication, just as if you had her write it out or just as if you had her place it there. By giving her information and having her parrot it, this is a very extreme case here where the defendants actually knew that. And for that, like, I turn you first to Jewel Combs' testimony. This is the grandmother's testimony at 2216. The grandmother talks about a meeting with Collier and Charles present, in which Miss Martin flat out says that she has been instructed to lie and that that is the only thing that she can do.
What's the difference between this and the run-of-the-mill kind of criminal case where a witness says something and then recants and says, well, they made me do it? Does that mean there's a civil rights case against the prosecutors or the police or whoever picked up the statement?
In this case, what the defendants did was so outrageously egregious in knowing, and all we have to prove for the fabrication is the knowing fabrication, and we have that. We have an admission from Sheriff Shortridge, and this is at page 2185, where he talks about there is no reason for them to have fed her information, like where the assailants parked the car, if they actually wanted to get a reliable statement for her. Yet they were pulling out maps. They were using Google Earth to show her where the house was, how to get there, where the assailants park. And Sheriff Shortridge's admission is that you would never do that if you actually wanted a reliable statement, if you actually thought this witness had had the information on her own. Instead,
are you saying there was nothing that she pointed out?
Yes. I'm saying there was no verifying.
I mean, it was the design of the stockings was one thing. I mean, there were a couple other things that it seemed like she knew that that weren't given to her. Am I wrong about that?
Well, recall over 7.5 hours of this interrogation that were unrecorded, that were required to be recorded, and they violated their own protocol, and they did not record. So the fact that she guessed that it was a certain type of stocking versus another type of stocking is hardly compelling evidence that she was actually a murderer when she didn't know who the co-defendant was. She guessed wrong. We know that the person she guessed was excluded by DNA. She didn't know where the assailants parked. She guessed wrong and had to be corrected.
She's the only one that's gotten convicted of a crime in this case.
And frankly, that's tragic. What the defendants offered her, she was charged with capital murder. She was given notice that it was death penalty eligible. And they told her, if you give this statement, you can go home tonight. And they let her go home tonight. And they told her, you'll only be charged with a non-felony offense. And you'll be given diversion. They told her, you won't see your kids ever again if you don't say these things. And then they gave her all of the salient information that appeared in her statement. And that is fabrication. It may not be your traditional fabrication where somebody's falsifying a written document, but Spurlock tells you that when you solicit, intentionally solicit false information from a witness, and
do we know that she was there at the scene when the scene was shot?
There's no evidence that she was there at the scene. What they told her was you were absolutely had to be there because your DNA was there. In truth, her DNA was not found there. What the evidence shows is that there was one piece of evidence, one piece of DNA on a sex toy that could not exclude her, could not exclude, which is different than being present, could not exclude, but also could not exclude the decedent's girlfriend, and could not exclude one in 67 people. So that would be, at a Bengals game, 1,000 of those people also could have been there. And that's just a could not exclude. And again, the decedent's girlfriend wearing her DNA, just as likely will have appeared on the sex toy, is the only evidence ever that she might have been there. And again, this is summary judgment. The inferences have to run in our direction, and our evidence has to be credited. And it's very clear that there was no fingerprints implicating her, there was no finding of her DNA, of her hair, there were no witnesses. The only thing that puts her there is this highly, highly incentivized statement in which they fed every salient fact to her.
Did you talk about
talk for a minute about the claims against the prosecutor?
Yes.
Because the standard is quite high, obviously, for you to overcome.
Yes.
The general rules of immunity applies. Why is the general rule to the immunity applies? Why is your case so exceptional?
And there are 3 points I'd like to make on that, if I can quickly. The first is that what's exceptional is this was dismissed at a motion to dismiss stage. So our factual allegations have to be credited, which means that this court, for this claim in particular, has to assume there was no probable cause. So you have to look at the destruction of evidence in the context of the fact that there was no probable cause, and then answer the question. So I think the court can avoid that larger question of whether destruction of evidence generally should be a prosecutorial function.
But what was supposed to have been destroyed? The letters that she wrote or the letters that she had?
The letters that she had, the exonerating
from
letters
her husband.
From Hall, Cody Hall, yes, saying that this never happened. Now, in this case, Prosecutor Hall, it's the only time in his career ever, he was using his personal cell phone. He admits that he was calling a witness, but not just a witness, a suspect who had confessed to capital murder without her attorney present on the phone. He had called her. And if this court is going to consider, I would urge the court, first of all, to follow the
rules. Is your strongest argument not just that the evidence was destroyed, but that it was destroyed in violation of a court order?
It was destroyed in violation of a court order.
You can keep going. Hopefully we can turn that off.
So it was destroyed in violation of a court order, and it was destroyed in the absence of any probable cause. So that's where you have to assume this happened stage-wise. And I urge the court also to look at the context of this case. This was a case in which Prosecutor Goldie, made this deal of the century where she did diversion for capital murder in an unrecorded phone call with her, and then you have Craycraft using, again, unrecorded personal cell phone calls.
I appreciate your point about the motion to dismiss, although that's typically where these things are addressed, right? This is an offense from suit. So yes, we take the facts in your favor, but this is typically the posture in which these cases are addressed. So, again, these requires a very exceptional case, in my mind, to eventually find the prosecutor not immune for acts that are customarily prosecutorial. And violation of the court order to me seems like your best argument. But even then, there are other ways prosecutors could be sanctioned for misconduct by the court or otherwise. So, what makes this case so exceptional?
In this case, you have two of the prosecutorial agents. You have Goldie using his cell phone to solicit sexual acts. You have Officer Jones also using his cell phone inappropriately in sexual ways. You have Craycraft using his cell phone. We don't know what's going on in that regard. All of them are represented by the same attorney, Davis, who secured this deal. Everything about this smells. Davis is representing
Goldie. It sounds like that's not what I was getting at, but
I'm sorry. I just think that those facts make it so exceptional that to dismiss before allowing any discovery on this claim, when you have a prosecutor who has admitted to having these phone calls and the destruction of evidence.
Okay. Thank you. You'll have your full rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lynn Zellin, and I'm here on behalf of the Montgomery County defendants, Fred Shortridge, Ralph Charles, Mark Collier, and Eric Jones in Montgomery County. I only have 9 minutes, so I'll skip to the chase. I'll start with the motion to dismiss. We obviously disagree that in Jackson it didn't matter what the statute was or it didn't matter what the state was. And we've distinguished Ohio law from Kentucky law regarding survivorship.
I understand the role of the state law. Crabs and Jackson seem to say if we just look at 1983 with a broad brush, it's a civil action, whatever it is. We don't drill down and look at. By the way, other circuits I think would disagree, but that's. I don't know why that depends on what Kentucky law says.
Well, I think in Krabs, Your Honor, the court was looking at when you're looking at a personal injury under 1983, does it matter if it was a physical injury or a psychic injury or a reputational injury? It was looking at the type of injury. What qualifies as a personal injury? It wasn't looking at what theories fall under the personal injury umbrella. And it didn't say, it didn't go so far as to say different legal theories should all be treated the same for purposes of survivorship. It said all different kinds of injuries should be treated as personal injuries when they arise under 1983. And that's what Jackson was applying when it looked at the malicious prosecution exclusion under Ohio law, which Ohio categorizes malicious prosecution not as a personal injury action, making it inconsistent with federal law. So under 1988, you can't apply it. Kentucky law, though, treats malicious prosecution as a personal injury claim, so it's not inconsistent with federal law, and it can be applied. And it ought to apply. The federal law claims should be treated like the corresponding state law claims under KRS 411-140.
So you're saying that the question of whether we treat federal claims on like the corresponding state claims will depend on state, whatever the state law is?
I think that the federal law claims will be treated like the corresponding state law claims, regardless of what state law is. But whether state law claims apply,
I'm not sure. I don't know. It seems to me that other circuits would agree, but I don't know that we haven't gone down the road where, I mean, we're far enough down the road, I'm not sure we're going back.
And you may not. I recognize that, but I don't think that Jackson went that far down the road because it was specific to Ohio law.
Okay.
This hasn't been considered under the Kentucky statute. Turning to the fabrication claim, in the other cases where this circuit has found enough facts to support a fabrication claim, there has been something reported by the defendants that either flatly contradicted the record or never even happened. In Spurlock, which is the case that Miller relies primarily on, at least out of this circuit, there was a statement made to try to cover up a previous statement. So the question was, it wasn't what was said in the statement, it was this the first time he talked to the police, or had there been prior conversations that they're pretending never happened, that they're creating a record to erase from history? And there's nothing in this case to indicate that the officers reported something that never happened. It's more of a difference of opinion as to how you interpret the evidence that's actually in the record. Because Martin has never disputed that she said what she said. She may have tried to retract it and say it wasn't true, but she never said I didn't say that. There's no proof anyone tampered with
her. But I take it the argument is not that she disputes that she said what she said. It's just that they pointed out to her on Google Maps where it was. They told her, they gave her certain information. She parroted the information back. She's essentially a mouthpiece. That's a fabrication because they are inventing the evidence and then using her as a conduit.
Well, I think I recognize that the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to Miller, and we have to draw inferences in his favor. But you don't have to ignore evidence that's unfavorable to him, such as Martin's description of the stockings, the fact that she, as early as 2012, was identifying to the officers who the victim was, who the perpetrators were, where it happened in Mount Sterling, that he was shot in his bed.
We know there's other evidence to show that she was on the scene when this person died.
Well, we know that there was other evidence that was consistent with her being present at the scene, including her DNA evidence, including the fact that she failed a polygraph test, or that a polygraph test indicated deception when she said she wasn't there, when she said she didn't tie her to the bed, and when she said she hadn't been told who shot him. That indicated deception. That adds to the officer's reasonable reliance on her statement and their belief that it was true. Now, maybe a jury, as Miller argues, could disagree.
Everything that really... It seems like a lot of people in this case kind of traveled in the same circle, regardless of whether they were actually there that night, okay? So I assume that people heard things or heard rumors or whatever it was. What does she say that would take her out of kind of the general group, general circle, and actually put her at the scene that may not, that we know what wasn't given to her by any of the officers? I don't know if that's kind of a complicated question, but you see what I'm saying?
Perhaps. Let me try to answer. She says she was there. And self-inculpatory statements have an inherent indication that they're reliable, right? People aren't likely to confess to murder. She tells us she was there. She tells us that the perpetrators use radios. She talks about the history between Nikki Miller and Cody and how they usually do these robberies and how she didn't understand why they did this one differently. She tells us that they use the front door to enter and exit. She supplies plenty of details that weren't told to her in the pre-confession interviews. And very importantly, that I don't want to lose sight of, she did this after consulting with an attorney of her choosing. And only after she spoke with him did she decide to confess and admit to her involvement. And she consistently named Miller as one of the two men who participated, as early as 2012, and then in 2015 when she was picked up again, but before the interviews started. So I think all of these factors that Miller's relying on, first of all, none of that really actually goes to his own culpability. They really go to her reliability and veracity. If you look at cases like Johnson and Lester, the fact that somebody is right about some things but wrong about others, or that their statement is maybe inconsistent with some other evidence, doesn't render their statement, doesn't vitiate probable cause. It just goes to their reliability.
Can you quickly address understood defendant Charles, who seems to have made a few statements, at least in the grand jury, maybe other places that were questionable. Why is he not different, I guess, in terms of some culpability here?
He may be a little different. He wrote the reports that they're accusing of containing lies. His grand jury testimony is, of course, subject to absolute immunity, and I don't think that's been disputed here on appeal. But if you're looking at his report, certainly he was the author of the majority of the written statements. But ultimately, the prosecutor received the entire file, including all the recordings. So to the extent there were any mischaracterizations or mistakes made in the written reports, they didn't have any material effect on the prosecution. And to the extent they did, each of the quote-unquote lies that Miller points out pertain to something other than Miller's involvement. They pertain to who the other woman was, where the car was parked, how much time Martin had spent in Mount Sterling prior to this case coming up.
So you're saying they're not material. They may be misstatements, but not material to as it applies to Miller, as the indictment applies to Miller.
Correct. They may undermine Martin's credibility, but they don't go to Miller's culpability. And if you look at the cases where there's been a reckless or false misstatement, there's been something ignored or omitted that went directly to, that would have essentially exonerated or proven that the plaintiff hadn't committed the crime at issue. None of the misstatements they're pointing to has that effect in this case. And then, just very briefly, I think the residual probable cause was ample here under Wesby, as long as they had a reasonable belief based on undisputed historical facts that probable cause existed, they're entitled to qualified immunity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
John Fife, he's the state police polygraph examiner in this case, and I believe I have 3 minutes.
I'm giving it to him.
But that says 10:28. Everything that I plan to say today is probably not especially relevant after listening to Ms. Logan. She talked about fabrication of evidence as the major claim for the appellant, and as that relates to my client, John Fife, they talked about throughout the case that the deputies had provided him facts about their investigation. The state police have nothing to do with this investigation. We provide polygraph services for people throughout Kentucky, for law enforcement agencies throughout Kentucky. So they're called up.
Your class is the person who gave the lie detector test, right?
Yes, Your Honor, yes.
Is that the only claim against your client?
Throughout the complaint, they kind of jointly made claims against all of the defendants. So I discussed that somewhere in my brief where I went through and said that, for example, this claim jointly refers to all of the defendants. However, there's nothing in here that would be relevant to John Fife, so I kind of broke that down. So really, the major claim against him, I think, would be the fabrication of evidence, where they claim that the deputies had given him...
For them to prevail against your client, they would have to show that he... that she didn't fail the polygraph and he reported otherwise? In other words, that he fabricated the result of the polygraph, or that he... he would have to be in on the scheme, is that correct?
He would, Your Honor, and, that goes to what Ms. Lowy said about a dispute of facts between the parties and taking the facts more favorable to the appellant, but there wasn't really a dispute of facts. At every turn, there was the defendant saying, here's what happened, and the appellant saying, that's not true, because here's a reason to doubt it, but without contrary fact.
Do we know if there's any further proof against your client other than giving the polygraph and commenting to the person who was taking
it? Your Honor, that's his only involvement with the case. There was more than one polygraph in this case, but the one that we talked about is Natasha Martin, and really he had nothing to do with it. He had no interest in the case. The polygraph section was called. Somebody there said, sure, bring in your witness. We'll do the polygraph. He did the polygraph examination. They took the witness back to Montgomery County. That was the end of his involvement. Obviously, you don't call the polygraph examiner to go to the grand jury or to be involved in the prosecution, because nothing he's done is going to be raised again then. I think, going back to the question of what they would have to prove to prevail against John Fife, they would probably have to prove that Natasha Martin is not guilty of the crimes to which she pled guilty and is currently under sentence.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Wida, here on behalf of defendant appellee Keith Graycraft. As of this week, this court has two unpublished opinions stating that prosecutorial immunity, that is, an absolute immunity that is second strongest only to judicial immunity, applies to these claims.
So what's the case for immunity applying to a prosecutor violating a court order?
Here it deals with the destruction of exculpatory evidence, and it's both Grog and State that would, Grog versus State, which is the first one that was an unpublished opinion written by Judge Cole, joined by Judge Seiler as well as Clay. While there's not anything directly on point, that sort of thing is covered by prosecutorial immunity from the rule announced in Inwood. And it's as you noted, because there are different ways for prosecutors to be liable for those actions. Such an accusation is something that's a bit like a discovery dispute. And that sort of thing is something that's intimately connected with the judicial process. And my friend on the other side...
It's like a discovery dispute where you spoil the most important evidence in the case. So it's not a minor discovery dispute, it's a pretty significant one if that's the analogy you want to draw. You basically ruin it. Chance their side prevail, arguably.
Not a minor dispute, sure, but prosecutorial immunity is absolutely.
I keep saying, I know, but this is like the worst case I've ever had. What's the worst case? What's a case for prosecutorial? What's a case where immunity doesn't apply?
The case where immunity doesn't apply is when the prosecutor acts as an investigator. When the prosecutor goes out.
So as long as they're doing something in their prosecutorial role, it's blamed. Because I don't think the cases say that. But that's. I'll give you this was. Sort of in the role of a prosecutor, and I totally agree with you that it's a broad brand of immunity. This is my mind. I'm trying to think of what would be more violative of prosecutorial duty than destroying the most exculpatory evidence that would help.
There's no doubt that some of the accusations can be distasteful, but this court opinion that was released this week notes that even when it's malicious, even for the Supreme Court in Imler notes that even when it's conduct that's clearly illegal, it still protects them. You can have professional investigations or sanctions.
So there's things that you do that the court hasn't said don't do, that, you know, skirt the edges. I get that. Just destroy the evidence on its own, I understand that. But there's an extra layer to this. The court has said, do this. So it's not just arguably illegal, it's also a violation of the court order. I mean, a prosecutor should just blatantly violate court orders. That's a tough place to be in, I think, for defendants.
At this stage, we have to take the allegations as true. But even then, again, there's no civil remedy for this. There could be criminal charges filed against the prosecutors, there could be professional sanctions or others. But there's just not a civil remedy here. That's what this court, that's what the Supreme Court has said in Imler, in Buckley, and it's what this court
recognizes. There's a circuit split, though, on this question of destruction of evidence, isn't there?
There is a circuit split, but that's because the Third Circuit views things very differently, and they have a much, like, looser...
That's what happens when you have a circuit split.
Well, that is true, of course. I did not mean to be tautological. But, again, this court's cases foreclosed that. The recent decision that came up, the Alexander case this week that we filed.
Those both were unpublished cases.
I mean, we're not analyzing
those cases. Foreclosed, not for it.
Well, but those unpublished cases recognize that the Cabrini case forecloses this, deals with the destruction of evidence. In that case, the prosecutor told the FBI agent, don't memorialize these 10 interviews. We think there might be exculpatory evidence.
So a court order violated that case?
No.
I get destruction evidence, I'll probably grant you, just for me at least, it's the court order that makes this a harder case.
Yeah, but while the court order makes it harder, it also draws it more clearly within the ambit of Imler, which is that it's intimately connected to the judicial phase. It's not even intimately, the test is not even that it needs to be intimately connected to a judicial process, it just has to be intimately connected to the judicial phase. And so when that happens, the court is in the driver's seat. And so it's the court that is overseeing the case that's able to do that, right? Hiding exculpatory evidence or destroying exculpatory evidence, even in violation of a court order, that's the thing that would chance the investigation. That's
not, I asked this earlier, you didn't answer it, I forget. But what's the case then where there is no meaning? What's the case? If you seem to be saying a blanket rule. I thought the cases said there are some exceptions.
Well, yes, it's always a functional analysis, but the sort of thing that would not receive immunity is, for instance, making comments at a press conference. That was covered in Buckley.
But this come up? Did this come from a telephone call between Craig Clapp?
But that's the allegation, yes, that it was a telephone call.
Did she call him or he call her?
The allegation is that she had called him and then that he had returned her call on a personal cell phone. But I should note, too, that even paragraph 177 of the complaint says that he did this to advance the prosecution. So even the complaint, which again we have to accept as true at the motion to dismiss stage, even the complaint says that this is conduct related to the judicial phase. Again, prosecutorial immunity is strong medicine. And the courts have recognized that this is the case even when there are allegations of maliciousness, even when there are allegations of a conflict of interest. The Alexander case goes through that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to start with the Montgomery County claims, because crediting our evidence, there is no evidence that she was there. What counsel was reciting was, again, their best case version of the evidence. So when counsel talks about the proof that Martin was at the scene, she says she was there, counsel says. Well, no, but she also says she wasn't there. And she says that she lied. And she says in front of Collier and Charles, I'm being forced to lie and say I was there. That's the evidence this court has to credit for summary judgment.
Which version do you believe? The one she said she was involved, or the one she said she lied about?
For summary judgment purposes, you have to assume the jury will credit Ms. Coombs' testimony and Ms. Martin's testimony. that she was forced to lie when she said she was there. Now, a jury at trial might credit the other one, but for summary judgment...
This is on which prosecution or on the fabrication?
This is on fabrication. I'm still discussing, although it's relevant, of course, to malicious prosecution because there was no probable cause. I think once we prevail on malicious on fabrication, the malicious prosecution is fairly obvious, and that's why I'm relying on the briefs for that, given the limitations of my time. She makes it very clear that she was lying and that that she was being forced to lie because of these threats to take her children, and that's the version this court has to assume in adjudicating summary judgment. And Webb makes this case very clear. This court in Webb had a witness who said, I did it, I didn't do it, I did it, I didn't do it. And the court was very clear, you have to accept the version favorable to the non-movement for summary judgment purposes in adjudicating summary judgment. So again, when she knew where the front door was, you have to credit our evidence that she was first shown it on defendant Charles' iPad, that he showed her a visual of the house, and that that's how she knew where the front door was. When counsel talks about she had the attorney of her choosing helping her, you need to credit Ms. Coombs' testimony that no, she didn't. And Ms. Martin, the Sheriff Shortridge is the one who hired that attorney for her, the same attorney who keeps representing all the defendants. When they say that the polygraph showed that she lied, again, you have to credit our evidence that no, it didn't. That Fife never produced that evidence. The expert Leo says no. That Martin says no, I was telling the truth during that. So again, if you credit their evidence, we have a summary judgment problem. But that's not how summary judgment works. Summary judgment says you have to credit our evidence. And for everything that counsel said that proved that Martin was supposedly at the scene, we have strong counter actual evidence with citations to the record to show that no, that is not proof she was at the scene. There is no evidence that she was at the scene.
Your position is every time a witness makes a statement and then decides she lied, that gives rise to cause of action, yes. Webb's on the other side, right?
Well, first of all, Webb gives us that. Webb says that if the witness goes back and forth, you have to, for summary judgment purposes, you have to credit the one that's favorable to the plaintiff. But second of all, this is a truly exceptional case. She was offered diversion for capital murder if she would just implicate my client.
Well, that's just about poor judgment on the part of whoever offered it, I guess.
And she was threatened that she'd never see her kids again, and that she'd go back, she'd hang for this, was the phrase Fife used, if she didn't. So she was very much threatened, carrot and stick, into giving this false statement. She immediately recanted. She immediately said in front of the defendants, who didn't even call her defense counsel, was in front of the defendants without her attorney, that was a lie. But Webb tells you when a witness flip-flops, that the plaintiff, the non-movement, gets the benefit of the version that credits them, because this is summary judgment. A jury should decide which version to believe and decide whether or not she was telling the truth when she said, I was forced to do this, they made me lie, and that is not the truth. I want to quickly address Fife, because it's very clear that his role was far more than what the discussion here entailed. He is the one who fed her most of the lies. He gave Ms. Martin the address. He instructed her that this was a sex crime and described the nature of the sexual relationship and where the wrist restraints were and how that played in. He gave her the specific theory of the case, and he was the one who was most aggressive in threatening her and in lying to her to tell her that DNA 100% proved her guilt. When that was very far from the truth, the DNA simply couldn't exclude her or the girlfriend or thousands of other people.
Okay, thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted, and the court may call it.